Good, well, lovely to see you all. On a gloomy evening like this in Cambridge, sin does feel rather plausible, I would say. Yes. So raising the issue, the matter of sin, really forces us to ask the question, what's wrong with the world? And what's wrong with me? And I don't think there's anyone, I don't meet anyone today who denies that there's a problem, a real problem with the world. I think the evidence for the mess of our world is pretty overwhelming. The clues for that are everywhere. Listen to the world today or watch the news at 6 p.m. and you get plenty of something wrong with our world. So both Christians, I am a Christian, I'm not assuming all of you are, I would say both Christians and non-Christians share that in common. That's my starting point. There's something badly wrong with the world. And for those of you who are Christians here, don't think that you or we have the monopoly on seeing evil. We don't. I'm often struck today, in the last 10 years, how well modern TV dramas uncover the reality of sin and evil. You think of a TV drama like Breaking Bad? Wow. What a diagnosis of the human condition. More recently, one set in Wales called Keeping Faith. Another remarkable uncovering of the human condition. That we may be outwardly respectable, but something internally is rather corrupt. I've actually come to conclude that many scriptwriters of these TV dramas know more about the mechanisms of sin than most preachers do, who address us on the subject Sunday by Sunday. So we don't have a monopoly on the sin matter. Now, while both Christians and non-Christians would acknowledge the reality of something wrong as a serious matter, there's a significant difference in how the problem is diagnosed and then labeled. We share something in common, but there's a difference in terms of the diagnosis and the labeling of the problem. And I would say this difference between the Christian and those who are outside of faith is so significant that when we as believers talk our message of sin, it's pretty much totally lost in translation. It makes very little sense as we proclaim our message of what's wrong with the world. It sounds hollow, abstract, and with little meaning. We also, as Christians, face a linguistic challenge. The word sin, quite quickly, has pretty much disappeared out of our vocabulary and has almost no currency or meaning. It's outdated. So that, too, works quite strongly against us when we start talking about this matter. So there's a massive challenge for those of us who are Christians when it comes to making sin plausible. Yes, there's a problem, but different diagnosis, a different labeling, and what kind of language are we going to use? Now, for those of us who are believers, this is how it is. Nothing makes sense out of our doctrinal framework without this doctrine of sin. It's what I'm going to call a load-bearing doctrine. It's not like an optional extra. Yes, I'll have that car and the one with the heated seats. It's not like that. It's like the engine of the car. Without the Christian doctrine of sin, almost nothing makes sense. So Jesus Christ, the incarnate one who came from the Father's right hand to earth, that makes no sense apart from sin. And of course, the gospel message is totally premised on the doctrine of sin. It's central to the message. Sin is the Bible's diagnosis of what's wrong with the world and what's wrong with us. It's our crisis, the Bible says, and Jesus came to rescue us from this particular crisis. So only if humans are sinners, with the content that the Bible gives that, is the gospel then good news. So it's load-bearing. So we're here, if we're Christians, having to communicate this central message of sin, and it's become incredibly challenging. I'm going to suggest that those of us who are Christians perhaps haven't appreciated just how challenging it is. And because it's so challenging, the contemporary church has either abandoned it altogether or readjusted it. Because secular people just don't get it. So we thought, well, we'll tamper with it. Perhaps we'll change its meaning to make it more palatable. Now, this would be another little series of lectures, how the church has done that. But one of the things it's done is to take the category of guilt, which is central to the biblical view of sin, and to change it to shame. Alan Mann, some years ago, addressed this in his book, Atonement for a Sinless Society. So the idea is that Jesus died on the cross to overcome our feelings of inadequacy, rather than to pay a debt for our moral guilt. So that's one shift that's happened. The other, I think, which is probably the more common one, is we get this sense that this message of sin is so incompatible with people who are outside the church that we just keep it low profile, kind of make it go fuzzy, and when we have to talk about it, just mumble. And hopefully we'll get through that, and then you can get to the good stuff. So one of the great challenges for those of us who are Christians is how to make sense of sin to those who are outside the church. And the question is, can we do that? Back in the 1990s, Christian philosopher and theologian by the name of Cornelius Plantinga wrote a great book on sin. The title is Not the Way It's Supposed to Be, A Breviary of Sin. And I love his opening to this book. It's about time someone put in a good word for sin. It's great. I'm trying to write at the moment. You always want your first line to sort of grab. That grabs. It's a grab. It's about time someone put in a good word for sin. I'm going to attempt to do that tonight. So I've got three headings. Firstly, I want us to hear, that's for those of us who are Christians, and later if you're not a Christian, you can say, I think you got it wrong or there's more. But I want for those of us who are Christians to hear how our message of sin comes across. So how does someone who's outside the church hear our message, briefly? Then secondly, this is the heart of the lecture, I want to look at three secular accounts for what's wrong with the world. So the equivalent of the secular sin narrative, or the secular sin labeling, as I'm going to call it. That's my second heading. And then hopefully, if you're still awake, I'm going to very briefly do a refresh on what I'm going to call the Bible's weightier account for sin. Okay? That's where we're going. What do I do with this? Oh. Okay. Thank you. Right. Am I back in action? There we go. Good. Typical responses to the Christian account of sin. If you're a Christian, it's good to be aware of this, to put yourself in the place of those who are listening to our account. How do they hear it? How do they engage it? And at the core of the Christian message of sin, I'll get to this a little bit more in a moment, is the confrontation to all human persons that we are moral agents. And that means we're responsible for our actions. And the twist that the Christian view gives to this responsibility is that it's ultimately before a personal and a holy God. And the message then asserts that when your life, your moral agency, is weighed on the balance before this personal and holy God, you are condemned as a sinner. And the Bible's incredibly strong and uncompromising on this point, sometimes going as far to talk in the language of evil. And therefore, because of being weighed in the balance and found wanting, you are deserving of some serious punishment, of judgment. And then comes the good news that Jesus has sent his Son to die in your place. He took on himself the judgment, the serious punishment, and that frees us to be forgiven before God. It cleans the slate. That's the message. How do people hear it? Well, three categories. In terms of response, first of all, that's immoral. They hear it as utterly immoral. For God to call us out on our sin is an outrage. And that's because the Christian message of sin against God is being reversed in the popular mind. And it's a case, not a case of us sinning against him. It's much more a case of God sinning against us. Now, I sense that many Christians are naive on this point, but I would say this is increasingly the default position in terms of how we're heard. And I would say it's consistent within the secular humanist perspective. Because if you're an enlightened secular humanist, you would say, with some justification, that we have created a better moral order for our worlds. And if you know a bit of history following the brutality of the religious wars of the 16th, 17th century, carnage everywhere, we stepped in and created something much better. So the secular mindset stands in the belief that humans are morally better than God. And if God does exist, he is the morally culpable one who actually deserves our condemnation. And if you want evidence of that, a secularist would say, who knows the Bible, look at the Old Testament. Here's a God who commands homosexuals to be stoned to death. Whew. Here's a God who ordered the genocide of ethnic peoples who happened to be occupying promised land that he wanted his favored ones to have. So the ethnic cleansing happened. So increasingly, the notion that God sees us as sinners is completely outrageous. He is much more the cause of what's bad about the world rather than the solution to its problems. A few years ago, I was with an atheist friend at the pub, the local pub. And we were chatting away, and he said, "Andrew, give me your gospel thing again, the thing you Christians believe." And I just gave it to him straight. I said, "The Son of God became incarnate, took on human flesh, and after living a perfect life, he died on the cross, and he did that to satisfy divine justice, and because of that, we can be made right with God." That's basically the gospel. His reply was this: "Okay, Andrew, let me tell you my gospel. If your God really existed, and if he came down in human flesh, and was incarnate, as you say, in this world, if he got on his knees, and he confessed his sin and evil to the world, if he did it long enough, sincerely enough, for all the children who died in agony, for all the cancer, for all the wars, if he absolutely confessed his sins for long enough, I might forgive him." Brilliant. I thought, we can have a conversation now. I think many believe that today, who are outside the church. And we need to understand that, those of us who are Christians. So that's the first response. The second is this: yes, there's evil in the world that needs judging, but it's not my problem. There's evil, bad stuff happens, but it's not my problem. So, no problem acknowledging that there are people who deserve serious punishment. There's Hitlers, there's Stalins, and today you might even add there's Donald Trumps. I mentioned a moment ago this TV drama series, Breaking Bad. Vance Gilligan is a guy who was the scriptwriter. Years before he wrote this, he had a Christian girlfriend. And he said she believed in heaven. "I'm an atheist," he says, "I don't believe in heaven, but I do believe in hell." Because Vance Gilligan knows some 20th century history. He knows about Pol Pot. He knows about Stalin. He knows about Hitler. And he says none of those people had to pay for what they did. So I believe in hell. There needs to be a judgment. He believes that. And I think many others do also. I think today many, within a global perspective, can see evil on a new scale. It's scaled up for them. We can see how Stalin's purge led to the misery, starvation, and death of millions. So we see evil on this giant scale, and we say, well, how does that relate to me? It just seems disproportionate, especially when the Bible, and its account of sin, lumps it all together, which it does. So it's just, yes, there's a problem, but not my problem. It's sort of more out there. The third category of response I would suggest is this one. Yes, there's something about me which is bent out of shape. My issue, though, is with your diagnosis of why that's the case. So I'm a mess. Many would acknowledge that. My issue is with your diagnosis. So I think increasing numbers today, especially of a younger generation, are beginning to acknowledge that they're messed up. The evidence is in their life. So here the TV dramas really are on to something. There's something bent and corrupt about humans. I'm actually struck by some TV dramas today. This was true of Keeping Faith, recently finished BBC. I couldn't see any redeeming characters. I couldn't see any good characters in the whole thing. They were all bad. I thought, oh, give me some good. Interesting. We're messed up. So I think increasing numbers may be able to relate to the part of the Christian message that says you need saving. There's something seriously wrong. There's a willingness to acknowledge a flaw. What they can't accept is our diagnosis for what's wrong. And that's where I'm going to go in my next point is how secular people diagnose the problem. So three common responses of what's wrong with people. The first is it's immoral when we give our message of sin. The second is not my problem, someone else's. There's real evil people out there. Go after them. The other is it is my problem, but it's the wrong diagnosis. So let's move on. Secondly, the three secular accounts for what's wrong with the world. Remember where I started? Both Christians and secularists agree that there's something wrong. The difference is in our account for this. The why of it. And I think it's really important for Christians to understand the account that the secularist gives. And I call these secular sin labels. So what I want to do now is to highlight how, what we call, I'm not insulting any of you who are not of faith. I'm not insulting them. Secularists, those outside the church, I want to look at how sin is being labeled there, or relabeled. And of course it's relabeled without using the language of sin. And what we need to see, those of us who are Christians, is actually, it's not a rejection of sin, it's just a renaming of it. It's giving it a different label, a different diagnosis. And actually, I would suggest this. As we examine the secular sin labels, the Christian needs to see and affirm the half-truths in all of them. There is a validity, I would suggest, to the diagnosis, to the labeling. I'd go so far as to say they add a huge amount to our understanding of sin. So we've got to listen to the secular sin narratives. Because sometimes we're naive about sin. So we can have a conversation here. We can learn from each other. So we have to take the secular sin narratives, the secular sin labels, seriously. That's my point. So what's the first one? Well, the first secular sin label is this. There's a problem with the hardware. Sin, you wouldn't use the language of that, sin is a hardware problem. So the cause of why humans misfire is a physiological one. So we've got an explanation very much here in the materialistic realm. So whatever is bent out of shape with me is how nature has determined me. It's just the way I'm hardwired. Now I would say Dawkins' selfish gene would fit under this labeling. Humans are hardwired to choose for their own self-interest, to promote our in-house gene pool. Some truth to that. It's interesting that recent discoveries in neuroscience have uncovered what's known as the cognitive self-serving bias. Lots of proof for this. What is it? Well, I'm just getting my head rounded now, but I think the idea is that our brains operate so we come to less than rational conclusions about ourselves. We call this self-deceit in terms of a theologian's explanation. So, self-serving bias, when good things happen, guess who that's attributed to? Me. When bad things happen, guess who that's attributed to? You. That's the cognitive self-serving bias. Now, we're not going to do it, but you can see how much sin and evil and terrible things flow out of the cognitive self-serving bias. Not a good thing. It's hardwired. It's in our cognitive faculties. There's some recent work in genetics. We've got a geneticist here. Here's where we're going to get in trouble. But there's been a focus on what's called the aggression gene. And it hasn't yet been discounted, I understand. The idea is that some people are more genetically predisposed to anger than others are. Just like some are more predisposed to psychosis than others. It's also related to the recent upsurge of interest in the psychopath. You notice on TV the obsession with mass murderers? Well, what kind of account can we give for these kind of psychopaths? And science is beginning to probe and say, is it in the genes? They're looking for hardware causes. Now, I want to say here that there's no doubt that hardware plays a part in the misfiring of humans. I worked at this community Jack talked about at the beginning, and homeless people used to come to our shelter called Labrie. And I saw some, as I sat with them for hours, who I just saw were hardwired for depression. Their parents were depressed, their grandparents were depressed. That depression made them look for compensation, which led to substance abuse, which in the end led to homelessness and a very, very difficult life. You could trace the links, and they needed to be taken seriously. Now, what's significant about this particular secular sin label is that it doesn't leave much place for the preacher or the theologian or the priest to address the problem. Prior to the secular age, who were the experts on sin? Theologians and priests and pastors. Now, we're moving to a phase where it's the scientist who's becoming the expert in sin diagnosis. So what place then is there for us in the church for diagnosing the problem, for commenting on it? And what's really interesting to me is that science is now taking increasing responsibility for moral matters. I would say up to 20, 30 years ago, science largely stayed clear of moral matters. You left that definitely to the theologians, and some brave ethicists might step in and comment also. But scientists, not our realm. But today, it has become the realm of science. Partly because of scientism. Scientism is the epistemology that says there's nothing in reality that's not under the remit of science. We have access to everything. It has to include what's wrong with humans. Leland sent me this a few months back. The Distinguished American Association for the Advancement of Science had a webinar last September the 4th. The subject was Impulses, Intent, and the Science of Evil. There were four main questions for discussion. Listen to them. How might we define evil as scientists, and whether there are evil people or just evil acts? A scientific association. The other question, so there was three questions, whether studying evil can broaden our understanding of the causes and triggers of violence. There was some aggression gene stuff in there. And then the third one is, what is the link between mental illness and evil acts? Interesting. Now, how is the Bible's account of sin heard within the secular sin labeling? When you tell a person that their moral culpability before God is the problem, their sin to God, they're going to hear it as, hang on, you're judging me for how I'm hardwired. You remember how the late Christian Christopher Hitchens used to say it? Christianity teaches that you're created sick and commanded to be well. That's cruel. Utterly cruel. So holding someone accountable under the hardware account labeling is a rather cruel thing, if that's what someone holds to vigorously. Now, I would say, while acknowledging the reality of the hardware account, the Christian would say rightly that there are some serious limitations to it. So here I'm beginning to push back and critique it. One of the real dangers of the hardware account is that it diminishes agency, which we'll pick up a bit in a moment. Now the fundamental problem is labeled as a disease. And this is how this labeling goes. We're diseased, neurologically, biologically. And that raises for me some huge questions that we can hardly touch on. But to put it dramatically, let me ask it this way. If the problems, the big, big problems of this world, are due in the end to the disease of hardwiring, how do you explain the Holocaust? Is it sufficient to explain the Holocaust? Is it sufficient to explain Auschwitz on the basis of the hardware account? And I agree with some modern moral philosophers who say that this actually leads to the banality of evil. If it's just a misfiring in your neurons, how do you account for evil at all? To account for Auschwitz, the death camps of Poland, Germany, you need some big metaphysical categories. And the hardware account doesn't provide those. So can we really look at the colossal evils of the 20th century and account for it merely on hardware terms? And I would suggest that the hardware account, if that's where we leave it, only makes evil banal and shallow. It's a terrible reduction. And it makes us passive in the face of great evil. So some ethicists rightly say this is a very dangerous place to be. If we reduce it to hardware, then what are we going to do against real evil in our worlds? And here I think the Christian account has a great contribution to the science of evil. It's something which is a joke, but we have the devil. And when you look at some of the great evils of the 20th century, the devil starts to make sense. Vance Gilligan says the same. Begins to make sense of the devil. I would say a proper understanding of evil on the scale of Auschwitz requires the diabolical. That evil isn't something just gone amiss in our neural circuits. It's a malevolent force that rages and burns with catastrophic consequences. And this is something that the hardware account doesn't account for. So that's the first one, hardware issue. The second is basically giving it a psychological cause, or if you like, a problem with our software. So where the last secular sin label attributed physiological causes, this one looks at psychological ones. So the problem is not so much in our nature as it is in our nurture. So it pays attention to the environment that disorders us. How many of you have seen the latest Joker film? Uh-oh. Spoiler alert. I mean, the Joker. You know the Joker. This is a pretty big fictional character of the last decades. We're fascinated with Joker. Here's someone who does really, really bad things, and he has a great time doing bad things. He dresses like a clown. Why does he do it? The new film tells us. He had a very difficult childhood, and I mean very difficult. There's the cause. It's a software issue. In the news, you often see the same secular sin label at work. I remember a few years back when a fairly normal child from a normal family brought a plane ticket and went to Syria to join a jihadi militia group. And journalists at quite a high level were discussing what made this normal kid do that. Probing the family background, probing the school ground, trying to find the software narrative for it. Now, Christians, again, should never ignore this side of the explanation. There is almost always, 99.9%, an element of truth to this, real truth. And Christianity is a theology of sin that can cope with that account, and we should never minimize it. I recently heard a heartbreaking story about a woman, young woman, normal, middle class, young, lots of promise, goes to the toilet in her bar and gets raped. The trauma of that rape is so huge that she begins not to be able to cope with her job. And before she knows it, she's on the street, homeless, drug addict, and a prostitute. I mean, that's devastating. Utterly devastating. And that provides the explanatory power, much of it, for what's going on there. And we need deep sympathy for this. Now, again, this particular secular sin label doesn't leave a whole lot for the pastor or the preacher or the theologian to address. It's much more the insights of the therapist that's going to be decisive for dealing with it, not so much the theologian. And where Christians would use the label of sin, the software account uses the label of a disorder. And the problem tends to be medicalized, and completely medicalized. So what's required for a solution is a therapeutic intervention. And they're often very successful. The therapist has the requisite tools to diagnose where this has come from and then to solve it, to suggest a way forward. And where the gospel might say, what you need is the forgiveness of Christ, the therapist would say, often rightly, no, you need a pill or you need a shrink. And that's often good diagnosis. It's what they need to hear. But on their terms, it's often hard for Christianity to compete because of this particular label. Now, how is our message of sin, if we're Christians, heard within this particular frame, this secular sin label? Well, when you tell a person they're a sinner and morally culpable before God, they're going to hear it as, hang on, you're judging me for my software? You're judging me for the abuse that I've experienced at someone else's hands? I have a serious mental illness that has blighted my life. And my therapist has helped me see that it's related to parenting issues. And you're telling me the problem is my sin against God? Huh. Again, it sounds cruel. But that's how it's going to be heard within that secular sin narrative. Now again, while acknowledging so much truth in this software account, Christians would say, rightly, that there are again some limitations to this account. It doesn't go far enough, or it goes too far. And I would say once more, this one falls entirely into the victim narrative. It does better than the hardware label, which makes evil totally banal, but it's still very victim-oriented. And in terms of big-scale evil, I don't think it goes far enough. It might do somewhat better at explaining Hitler and what happened, his background, social conditions, but for me, doesn't go nearly far enough. The other limitation I've raised in this software account is that it tends to reduce persons to their mental disorder. And it actually does this in a way that the hardware account doesn't. I don't hear many describe themselves primarily from within their brain chemistry or their genes. Hi, I'm Andrew, and I'm angry because this is my genetic composition. I haven't met anyone who sort of worked like that, but I meet lots of people who say, hi, I'm Andrew and I'm depressed. Or in a conversation, say Andrew, and they're designated primarily as, I'm someone who's been abused. Very serious issues that have to be taken very, very seriously. But it becomes a primary way of identifying. One becomes defined by their condition, by their mental health issue. And I think Christianity has an anthropology which wouldn't allow for that. It would take totally serious the disorder, compassionately, it should anyway, but it doesn't ever allow that to primarily identify a person. No one is defined essentially by how they've suffered at the hands of others. And I found breakthroughs of those I've been working with who've been deeply, deeply hurt by others by helping them to see that. Your mental disorder doesn't primarily define who you are. You're more than that. Christianity says you are the imago Dei. You're the image of God. There's something deeper about you than you being a victim of another person's sin. Take it very seriously, but it doesn't primarily define you. So that's the point there. Okay, the last secular sin narrative or label is sick society. Do you remember back in the summer of August 2011? Do your minds go back that far, your memories? They were the summer of riots in this country. And David Cameron, the prime minister of the time, talked about sick society. And there was lots of comment because obviously dear David was shocked that a grammar school girl was caught up in this riot. Like, upper class, what's she doing? She's in the riot. We've got a sick society. A few weeks back, this is devastating, wasn't it? It's almost unthinkable. 39 Vietnamese people found dead in the back of a refrigerated trailer. I mean, it's hard to get the head around it. And it was interesting. BBC News was going around getting comments from people, and I was struck how many said basically the same thing. The society we live in isn't right. So this secular sin label accounts for the problems of the world as something out there. Society is given the face of evil. Society is the baddie. Society is oppressing us and we're his victim. So what goes wrong with humans is directly related to sick society. That's why I committed the crime. Society made me sick. And it cites things which again have validity. A poor education. I've been shocked to hear a preacher from a pulpit occasionally say, education, it's sin that's the problem. No, education leads to human flourishing. It's so important. Many people with almost no education go to a life of crime. The lack of social mobility. In cities, people locked into suburbs, very young. 14-year-old boy stabbed a few days ago, part of a drug gang, 14 years old. Join a gang, get involved in drugs, and a life of crime, the knife problem, and all the rest. Now again, Christians shouldn't write this labeling off too quickly. It plays a real cause in disordering us. And I think this aspect of the labeling requires today some very careful thought and attention. And for Christians, it should be the spur to a certain kind of social action. And in the past, that has happened because Christians saw what sick society really does. Now, this particular sin labeling, I think, can be traced back to the 18th century to the Swiss-born philosopher Rousseau. It's easy to blame Rousseau for lots of things, but I think we can really blame him for this. In his discourse on the origins of inequality, Rousseau argues that humans in their original state of nature were not sinful. It reverses the Christian narrative. We were born into a state of innocence. And what was the reason for our state of innocence? There was no society. Interesting. You see, people who were pre-society didn't feel greed or envy. Their only natural emotion was pity and kindness to the suffering of others. This is what we call his noble savage theory. So according to Rousseau, the human problem was the discovery or the invention of human society. And that existed outside of individuals. It was a mass of rules and injunctions and strange relationships, and it was the obstacle to our human flourishing. Society is the cause of the bad. We're good naturally, society makes us bad. Now that is so instinctive in almost all of us today that we're not even conscious of this thinking. So often when people are accused of a crime, they raise the defense in some form or other, society made me do it. Now today this labeling is linked to the ideology of Michel Foucault, a 20th century French philosopher. We can blame the French speaking for so much. Foucault sees society through the prism of power. So those who hold power are the perpetrators of what's bad. Those who hold power are the real sinners. So society is no longer a complex system of trust and traditions that evolve over time. It's just badly executed power. And that's what oppresses the majority. And that power today is white, straight males. They've had the dominant power. So to expose evil is to see through the web of power that you've been born into in terms of your society. We've got to deconstruct these power plays. We've got to unmask the evil of misused power, the power that's kept down minorities. Now, this is the dominant ideology today in, I would say, all of our Western institutions, and especially the academy. This sin narrative works very, very well. And again, what can a preacher or a theologian say to this? The experts on diagnosing evil are who? The social scientists. Who has all the power in the university? It looks like the social scientists. Sorry, Leland, it's not the geneticists. It's the social scientists. They're the ones who expose this sin and evil. Now again, it's useful to hear how the Bible's message of sin is heard within this labeling. You tell someone they're morally culpable before God if they're sinning, they're going to hear it as, hang on, you're judging me as a sinner for the oppression of my society? I'm the oppressed one, you're telling me I'm a sinner. It makes no sense. And of course today, when a Christian preaches this message, we're preaching white man's religion. So that makes it even more difficult in terms of how it's going to be heard. Christianity is the cause of so much of the oppression. This is where the moral outrage response comes in. So here we've got a lot going against us in terms of our sin narrative, ours as Christians. This really does making sin plausible a huge challenge. Now again, while affirming some aspects of this labeling, this diagnosis, there's also some serious limitations. And once more, as with the other accounts, this one falls into a victim narrative. I'll return to that in a moment. The limitation I point out here is the assumption about human nature, back to Rousseau. Human nature is essentially good, and it's society that's bad. So if we get society good, human good can flourish. Justice will prevail. So you just got to make society right, and salvation will come. Now, this is largely today, we talk about the social justice warriors. Much of their cause, we can see, has merit to it. But the thing itself is run largely by a younger generation who have become ahistorical. Because we've tried this kind of social engineering several times in the last 100 years. In 1917, Vladimir Lenin tried it in Russia. And did he create, through his social engineering, a better world? No, he created an absolute monster that killed millions. Hitler? Great, giant social engineering experiment to solve the problem, to make it better, to restore it to what it should be. Another disaster for the human race. In fact, I would say history gives us no evidence that social fixes deal with the problem. In fact, most of the time, it's a revolution. It comes in a revolution and it makes things worse. History says there's a limitation here, and we need to be careful with it. So there are the three dominant secular sin labels of our time, each with a diagnosis that has some merit, but each requiring a critique, because it doesn't go far enough. Now, I'm out of time. I'm going to just whistle through the headings of my last point. Some concluding comments on the Bible's weightier account, touching these extremely briefly, places where the Bible's labeling actually conflicts with the secular sin narrative. The first is this. The Bible's sin labeling and diagnosis doesn't confuse symptoms for causes. This is such an important point. Broken biology, psychological disorder, social conditions are not seen as the ultimate causes of what's wrong with the world. They're just symptoms of a deeper problem. That's where we go. So the Bible's view has the kind of categories for us to distinguish between true symptoms and true causes. So we can look at the secular sin labels and say, these are significant symptoms. We've got to take them seriously, but they're only symptoms. They don't actually get to the root ultimate cause. They're just part of the story. And even if you put the three together, it wouldn't make up the full picture. So that then comes to the second point, which is the Bible emphasizes the problem of the human condition. It's the condition which is the problem. That's the cause. So sin, the Bible says, is a corruption that touches the whole person. Immanuel Kant, German philosopher, used the most apt phrase. He talked about the crooked timber of humanity. The crooked timber. There's a flaw at the core of us that keeps throwing up errors. We are at the very center, what the Bible calls the heart, bent and corrupt. And our orientation is therefore crooked. That's the problem of our condition. So locating the problem of the sin in this way, in the causal way, it does two things. First of all, it makes sin personal. It's not just physiology or mental health or social structures, all of which can bypass the personal dimension. When we say it goes to the core of the human condition, we make it a personal matter. It's me who's the sinner. Not my genes, not my depression, not the social construct. It's me that's the problem. And that, we can't develop this, gives a solid metaphysical category for sin and evil. You bring the personal into it, which has intentionality and motive, and suddenly we are lifting the categories to begin to really understand what's wrong with the world. The second thing this does, making it the human condition, is that it makes us agents as well as victims. This is key. Stressing sin as the problem leaves room for both of these categories. Yes, we're victims. Yes, we're agents. We've looked at all the reasons why we are victims of our hardware, of mental health issues, from the abuse of others, from our social conditions. But we're also agents. That's what this personal dimension brings to it. It's the human condition. And no one is exempt as an agent. All have sinned. And I would say the problem with the secular accounts is that it doesn't take agency seriously enough. And that's why it's produced a culture of victimhood. Everyone can see that today. We're just victims. There might be a few that we can blame for the problems of the world, but it's not my problem. So what the secular sin labels tend to avoid is how everyone contributes personally and intentionally to the problems of the world. And I would say the secular sin labels have no reason to give the kind of account that G.K. Chesterton did during the Great War in the middle of the century. Apparently it's apocryphal. We don't know if it's true, but the way the story is told is that the Times newspaper invited several journalists to address the question of what's wrong with the world, this great war happening, killing Europe, blowing it up. They made their various responses. Here's Chesterton's. Dear sirs, I am yours truly, G.K. I am the problem of the world. Wow. He got it. That's the biblical view. That's what its account pushes us to. And I think the evidence for it is obvious. Now, this emphasis on being an agent of sin may not be flattering, but I'd say it is freeing. Because it means we can begin to take some responsibility for our lives. This is part of the attraction, I think, of Jordan Peterson. I think he's questioning this kind of victim mentality. He's saying, get up in the morning, certain time, you can get up, clean your room, and stand up straight. And what are you going to do with your day? How are you going to exercise your agency? It's as simple as that in terms of what he's doing, or some of what he's doing. So it gets back, we have got to get back to this matter that we are agents making sin a personal matter. We have what philosophers call intentionality. We have future-directed thoughts that we act upon, and acting upon them makes a difference, especially at the interpersonal level. We can be of great good and blessing to others because we're agents, and we can be terribly destructive. Maybe I'll just morbid. But I knew as a father, young father of young children, that I was probably going to be some blessing to my kids, and I was also going to mess them up. I just knew that. I would leave them in some ways damaged. Because that's how sin functions. Weighty thing. So, here's where I finish. For the Christian who's here, the biblical view of sin may not be plausible to those who are outside the church, who would not say that they're people of faith. But I think we have to stand firm and say that here we have a view of the human condition with the explanatory power to show what it really is. And it honors, I would say, what it means to be human. That we have agency, we have intentionality, and we act with moral culpability because of that. And our view might not be easily accepted by anyone else, but has a far greater reach than the secular sin accounts. We shouldn't let go of it, despite the resistance, because it's true. And the Bible says it's true. And I'd also say, to those of you who are Christians, listen more carefully to the secular sin labels. You can learn a lot from them. Okay? And then I'd say to those who might be here who are not Christians, who would define yourself as secular in some way, who doesn't subscribe to what Christianity says, I would just say, look at our account more fully and see what you might be able to learn from our account. I've suggested that your accounts don't go far enough, and this is the shortcoming. And for that reason, I'd say it's worth at least considering the sin account that Christianity offers. Okay, I'm going to leave it.